Welcome to Coaching DNA Podcast. I am your host, Travis Wyckoff. My guests on this podcast are coaches, athletic directors, sports psychologists, and really anyone else that can add value to leaders. In each episode, we spend time exploring leadership, culture, development, personal growth, and much, much more. The guests are different in many ways, but share profound similarities. They are hungry to get better, they are guided by purpose, and they are driven to develop the people around them. Each episode allows us to dive into what skills, attributes, and giftings make up great leaders. When I'm not doing this podcast, I run Kingdom Coaching. It is my consulting business where I coach coaches. I work with coaches one-on-one, I work with coaching staffs, as well as run online cohorts. Additionally, I write a weekly email newsletter to resource coaches with tools and strategies to be better leaders and coaches. To find out more, visit my website at kingdomcoachingtw.com. And please check me out on Twitter at kingdomcoachtw or at coaching_DNA and give me a follow. I hope you enjoy the show. My conversation this week is with Jim Schlossnagel. Jim is the head baseball coach at TCU. Jim has built a phenomenal program there at TCU. During our conversation, we talk about his journey from coaching as a college student to TCU. We talk about how he has hired great assistants and that being one of the keys to his success. We talk about hating to lose more than loving to win, clarifying culture, and much, much more. Jim is regarded as one of the best college baseball coaches in America. And this interview will give you, I think, a glimpse into why that is. I found Jim to be really engaging and authentic. So without further ado, my conversation with Jim Schlossnagel. Jim, thanks so much for taking time to join us. Why don't you walk us through your journey from high school to present day?
Sure, yeah, and thanks for having me on. I am from Hagerstown, Maryland. I was born in Baltimore. I grew up in a small town in western Maryland, right where West Virginia, Maryland, and Pennsylvania come together, right where very few people in Texas know what the Mason-Dixon line is. That's the line that's the border that separates Maryland and Pennsylvania. It's basically separated the North and the South in the Civil War. And I grew up pretty much right on it. And so went to, you know, played three sports there, had a great upbringing, great Christian upbringing with both parents, and ended up going to school in North Carolina at a great place at when I was there called Elon College. It's now, it was NAIA Athletics at the time. It has since become an NCAA Division I school. It's now Elon University and just a great, great place. And enjoyed my time there. I grew up, at least in high school, really interested in journalism and writing. And I actually worked from my sophomore year in high school to my senior year in high school for my hometown newspaper, which probably had a circulation of about 50 to 80,000, I'm guessing.
Wow.
So I would literally play a high school basketball game and then drive into the newspaper. And this was back in the day when high school coaches would call in the box score. Mm-hmm. And I would type up the box score, maybe a little review of the game in Agate, what they called then. And it would go in the newspaper the next day. And then graduated eventually to my senior year of high school, where I would actually go out and cover games. So I state softball championship. And I thought that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to write for Sports Illustrated. Thank goodness, you know, that kind of medium, magazines and the sporting news and all that kind of stuff is really a dying thing. Mm-hmm. It's all online now. There's still some jobs, but certainly a different industry. So in my sophomore year of college, I was on the baseball team at Elon, and I was on the team. I can't tell you that I was the greatest player, right-handed pitcher, but I had walked on the team and was contributing to the program. And my college coach, a guy named Rick Jones, called me in one day and said, "Hey, listen, I know you're majoring in journalism, and we both know you're not playing in the big leagues, which I knew that. And he said, I think you'd make a good coach. And I had never thought about coaching. And so I certainly thought a lot of him. And he said, why don't you step away from baseball for a week, come back and talk to me. And met with my parents, prayed on it, and came back and said, all right, that's what I'll do. So I changed my major to education and worked towards that. Did my student teaching the spring of my senior year, half in kindergarten, actually, and half in high school, and was a student assistant baseball coach. He actually left Elon about a month and a half after that conversation to go to Georgia Tech as an assistant coach. And the guy that they hired at Elon at that time, Mike Harden, really, really just the sweetest man ever, good coach, great, positive person. There were no assistants at Elon. So I was a student assistant, and by my senior year, I was coaching third base and coaching the pitchers and visiting the mound. And these are my buddies that I'm in that I'm running around with. So
that's great.
But I just developed a passion for coaching. And so in the summertime, I would actually go recruit as a college student. I would go recruit and watch games, and I got to sit around, great Division I coaches and assistant coaches at that time who are now legends in our profession, and also some great scouts who are now, scouting directors, general managers in Baseball Hall of Fame stuff. I mean, they're just phenomenal influences on me. But I would also work baseball camp in the summer to try and learn, to try and make money, and also just broaden my network. And one of the places I was working at the time was Clemson University, and I would work there camp every summer for 3 or 4 weeks. And I graduated in the spring of 1992, and the athletic director at Elon, who had been one of my professors, offered me the opportunity to come back. They were going to pay for my graduate school, give me a free ticket to the cafeteria, and basically put me in a glorified closet of an apartment in the gym. And so I was like, perfect, free school, free food, free place to stay. What else do you need? And so I said, I'm in, I'll take it. I'm just going to go work these camps this summer to have some money. And on my very last day, this is the summer of 1992 in August, my very last day of my very last week of camp, around August 1st, the NCAA rules changed on that day. Scholarships went from 13 to 11.7, so a 10% reduction, and coaching staffs got cut in college baseball. And so that was a horrible, horrible day for a lot of people, but it happened to be a really good day for me because I'm at Clemson, haven't turned 22 years old yet, so I'm 21. And the head coach at Clemson, one of the legends in our sport, by a guy by the name of Bill Wilhelm, who had been the coach there for 38 years. He was 67 years old at the time. He called me in and said, hey, we have this new thing called a volunteer coach. I can't pay you. And he knew what I had going on at Elon. He said, I can honestly not even advise you to do this because you have such a good situation at Elon, which was an NAIA school. He said, but if you want, I would love to have you come help me coach the pitchers at Clemson. And I was like, are you kidding me? I'll pay you to coach at Clemson University. So I drove my 1986 Honda Accord back from Clemson to Elon, told my parents what I was doing. The athletic director at Elon said, you got to go do that. Congratulations. Went back to Clemson and then was there for a full year working with Coach Wilhelm, and the top assistant at the time was Jack Leggett, who was, obviously an ABCA Hall of Fame member, became the head coach the next year. And then also Randy Mazie, currently the head coach at West Virginia, who ended up being on my staff at TCU for, I think, 5 or 6 years. And then after we won the ACC tournament in 1993, and then my college coach, Rick Jones, who had talked me into that, remember, he had gone to Georgia Tech, he got the head coaching job at Tulane and asked me to go with him. And so I left Clemson as I was the volunteer to get a paid position at Tulane for a cool $12,000 during the academic year. and a $4,000 cap in the summer on camp. That's since that was a position they created. That's in baseball and men's and women's basketball, I think, just those sports, called the restricted earnings coach, which eventually there was a lawsuit and they eliminated that. And we actually got a little bit of back pay, not much, but a little bit. And anyway, I was at Tulane for 8 years and helped get that program off the ground, helping Coach Jones. And we ended up, that kind of culminated in 2001. We played LSU. It was Skip Bertman's last year. Ended up being his last game in a super regional at Zephyr Field, which is the AAA park of the New Orleans Zephyrs there in Tulane, in New Orleans. And we had almost 20,000 people at the game. At the time, it was the largest outdoor crowd ever. We beat LSU in game three to go to the College World Series for the first time, which was great. And then about 2 weeks after that, I had some head coaching opportunities, but none that I really felt good about. And I interviewed and was offered to be the head coach at UNLV in Las Vegas. And I had never even been to Vegas except for the interview. My wife at the time, and you know, she's from Dallas and had two young children, and it was crazy to move to that side of the country, but I thought it was an incredible opportunity. And it certainly was that. And so moved to Vegas, coached there for 2 years, took over a program that had five straight losing seasons. And with the day I took the job, we had no recruiting class and no scholarship money. If you can imagine how that's supposed to happen, what they had done is just reinvested scholarship money in the returning players before the coaching change was made. And so I had a couple kids sign professionally. Gave us a little bit of money to sign some transfers back in the day where kids could transfer. In my first year there, we were 30-30, which wasn't a losing record, but it wasn't a winning record, but it felt like a winning record. And then the next year we were 47-14, won the regular season, won the conference tournament, played into a regional final at Arizona State, and ran into a buzzsaw of a team with Pat Murphy and Dustin Pedroia and about five or six other future major league players. And then about a week after that, 2 weeks after that, I always had my eye on the program at TCU. That was the place that, for me, everybody says they have a dream job. For me, that was my dream. And for a lot of reasons, which we can talk about, but they had a coaching opening. They had interest in me. I had interest in them. And especially with my wife being from Dallas, it was just too easy not to get back, you know, around some level of family, especially for her to get some support. And so made that move and have been at TCU there in Fort Worth for now 18 years.
Love it. Okay. Rick Jones pulls you aside, says, "I see a coach in you." Did he give you some feedback on what he saw in you? What was it that he saw?
You know, we've never really had that conversation other than I remember, you know, I'd keep a picture way down the list, and I'd have to keep a chart, and I'd be standing next to him, and we just talked a lot of baseball. You know, we talked about, you know, strategy. We would talk practice. I mean, he knew we were very similar upbringing in terms of his parents and faith and stuff like that. And I've always been a guy that it's weird. When I was young, people thought I was older than my age. And as I just turned 50, and there are times when I meet people that think I'm 43. So it's weird. I guess that's a good thing. But anyway, I was kind of just an old soul, I guess. But I don't know. You'd have to ask him that question. That's probably a good thing I need to ask him. I spent some time with him this past summer, but I think he was also just looking for some help. And I did throw really good batting practice. I could hold a video camera, and I was just real passionate despite my, you know, I knew my role in the program. So I was really excited to do that. And I think as a coach now, when you run across someone like that, it's hard to find good help. And at the time he wasn't planning on leaving. He had one kind of volunteer from the community coach that was helping him some. He was honestly probably just looking for some help. And so, you know, hey, here's a guy who's passionate about the sport, has some level of knowledge. He can throw really good batting practice. And and he's loyal. And, you know, that led to a conversation when you ask people, you asked me earlier about advice to people. I mean, you know, I don't know if I should be giving anybody advice, but one thing that he said to me, I'll never forget: the three most important qualities of an assistant coach. The third most important, it's important, but it's the least of the three. And that's knowledge of the game, right? I mean, that's something that you can eventually, you have to be a lifelong learner. You have to be passionate about, you know, how can we do this a little bit better? Or you have to feel good about what you're doing. You know, I mean, I believe in being a lifelong learner. And so I think that's something you can teach over time. The second most important is work ethic. You know, you get somebody that shows up every day, has great energy, isn't afraid to do the work. Somebody that I believe coaching is a lifestyle. It's not a profession. This is not a 9-to-5 thing. I understand people have to have an outlet. But I'm also, whether this is right or wrong, I don't believe you get to Omaha on a golf course. And so there are times for other things, and there's certainly time to be with your family. No doubt about that. That takes precedence after your faith. But if you think that Saturdays are going to be off, I mean, you need to go pick something else to do. So the second thing is work ethic. And then the most important is loyalty. Is somebody, just like in any relationship, somebody you can trust, somebody that you know when you ask them to do something, that's what they're going to be working on. Whether they do it right or wrong is another topic. But if you think about it, if you have somebody who's a really good baseball person, but they're lazy and you can't trust them, then they're useless. Or if they're a good baseball person, they work hard, but you can't trust them, then they're useless. But on the flip side, especially given your talent pool, you know, whether you're a high school coach, a junior high coach, or American Legion, all the way to college baseball, if you have someone that you is a good person, they're loyal to you, they work their rear end off, and they just want to aspire and learn the game, well, you can find a place for that person, right? I mean, that person has great value. And you know, I've never really, you know, thought about your question, but I think that's probably what he saw. And those three qualities, anytime I interview somebody, that those are the things I talk about.
Yeah. It's so funny, Jim, as I was kind of going through your history and doing some prep for this interview, so you were born in 70. I saw that on your Wikipedia page. I was born in 73. So you're 3 years older than me. And I didn't spend a ton of time, but I'm like, he should be older because he's been everywhere for a long time. Well, now it makes sense that you spent three of your coaching years in college.
Yeah. You know, yeah. I tell people, you know, in the first year of volunteer coaches in 1993, volunteer coaches weren't allowed to dress or travel to the away games. You were only allowed to dress and be a part of the home games. And of course, you're part of every practice. And what was weird is if you made the NCAA tournament, which we did, and there was only 48 teams instead of 64, if you made the NCAA tournament, then you could dress and be at the game. So what's crazy is I am coaching at Clemson. I'm 22 years old. We're playing Georgia Tech at home. Jason Veritek is the catcher. Nomar Garcia-Para is a sophomore, I think, shortstop. A guy named Jay Payton, who played a long time in the big leagues, is playing center field. We have four or five big leaguers on our team. There's about 6,000 people there. And we had a fifth year senior on the team named Chad Phillips, who was a really good left-handed pitcher. And I remember Coach Wilhelm sending me to the mound to go talk to him at like this most crucial moment. And he looked at me and said, "What in the heck are you doing out here?" Because he was 6 months older than me. And I patted him on the butt and said, "I'm not sure either, buddy. Good, go get him," and walk back to the dugout. So, but yeah, I mean, this will be my 30th year of coaching. So I've been very, very blessed, very lucky. And, you know, I've never lose sight of the fact of how blessed I've been in this profession.
Love it. Okay. I'd love to talk about, Jack Leggett. So he was a coworker with you there. As you're working with him for the 1 year, as you're seeing him operate, what are the things that stuck out that just had, you know, then the next year, starting up for years after being a really, really successful head coach? What are those things that you saw, those attributes or those gifts you saw in him?
Yeah, just absolute sick passion and energy. Like, now, great coach, phenomenal organizer, relentless recruiter, phenomenal father, has two great children, Colby and Tanner, who are both doing so well right now, married to the profession, just everything you would ever want to be. And it is literally a travesty. I won't get into my own opinion on what happened at Clemson for him, but it's literally a travesty that he's not still coaching, and he still should be coaching. If I was an athletic director today, given the right situation, he'd be one of my first calls. And his aid, you know, his mind, his body, his energy are certainly not reflective of his chronological age, which is young still, I think, you know, in his 60s. So, but he's just learned so much from him, even just a short time, but we've stayed very, very dear friends the entire time. And, you know, Rick Jones has had, and Bill Wilhelm had the most immediate impact on my career. But I've tried to learn from everybody, you know, that I've worked with, and I have, you know, sometimes you learn things that I know I want to do. And sometimes you learn things, yeah, I probably won't do it that way. And that's fine. I certainly have staff that feel that way right now. And if I have one major regret in my profession is, and I would encourage people to do this, I encourage every young coach to do it, is journal. Like, what I would give for just a daily journal of experiences that I had at Clemson for Coach Wilhelm, at, you know, with Jack Leggett, with Coach Jones, on the USA teams with Tim Corbin and Mike Bian, all the guys that I've worked with in USA Baseball, and just to be able to go back, because you forget things. I remember the funny stuff. I remember the big situations. But what I would give to have daily practice plans, or just, you know, recollections from, hey, what happened today? Because I mean, I'm a decent coach now. I could be way better if I would have done that throughout my career.
Give me two or three coaches that you would, if you could take some time off during one of their, you know, during a fall or a spring, that you would love to go spend two or three weeks and just watch how they work, how they run their program. Yeah, two or three coaches right now that are coaching that you kind of most admire and love to learn from.
In baseball. Yeah, because my biggest coaching guys I study aren't in baseball. They're in football normally. But, he's no longer with us, but and we got very, very close at the end of his life. But Augie Garrido would top that list. I would love to have spent more time around Coach Burtman at LSU. Even though I got to watch, you know, it was a good and bad thing to be in the state of Louisiana in the 90s at Tulane when they're winning five national championships, you know, so I got to see it, but not as close as I would have liked. Obviously Tim Corbin's been a very, very dear friend of mine for a very long time. We've coached together on USA teams. But if I could just break away and spend, you know, I would say Coach Garrido, Coach Burtman, and I'm a huge fan of Mike Bianco. He's one of my dearest personal friends. We talk a lot. We coach together. But I think, you know, he's had some unfortunate things happen in super regionals. You know, I don't think people realize the thin line between winning and losing once you get to that point. Much less in today's college baseball, the thin line between winning and losing just a freaking game in March is so hard to do. But to win a super regional, he's been to Omaha, I think one or two times. But I just think he runs one of the truest comprehensive baseball programs in all of college baseball. When you take into account on the field, off the field, promotions, crowd, everything. I mean, they really, and he built that, and it was obviously an LSU model. So there are many others, but those would be my three.
Yeah. Love that. What about yourself? What are your, if I were to poll the people that have been around you over the last 10, 15 years, what are your strengths? What are your giftings that have allowed you to be successful?
I mean, it's hard for me to, try not to be an ego guy. And I think humility is an important trait, but number one, I've done a really good job of hiring coaches. And, if you want to get to where you want to go, man, you got to hire some people that are A, smarter than you, better than you, challenge you, don't think the same as you, others that, I do believe you have to have the same, concrete core values of who you are as a person, because that will never work, i.e. loyalty. Faith's important to me. I don't have to have a coach that is deep in their faith. They just have to be a good person. But I love, I've been real fortunate with the coaches that I've hired. Buddy Goldsmith, who's eventually succeeded me at UNLV, is now a scout in the Royals organization. Todd Whitting, I get a lot of credit for getting TCU's program off the ground, but Todd Whitting is the one that had his nose in the ground and was signing players and coaching. He's doing great at the University of Houston. Randy Mazie, obviously. A guy named Matt Siegel, who now is out of baseball, but was a third base coach for the 2012 Arizona Wildcat national champion. And then, and then my staff now. I mean, Bill Mosiello is the best pure baseball person I've ever been around and a grade A human being, as is Kirk Sarlos, one of the premier pitching coaches in all of baseball at any level. And they're both great guys and they work like crazy. So our volunteer coach is just an absolute rock star in waiting. And in 15 years, you'll look up and they'll be talking about John DeLauro the same way they talk about Tim Corbin today. But for me, so that's first and foremost has been that. And then I think the second thing would be, and this is also a negative trait, is I do look at this profession as a lifestyle. And so, I like to fish a little bit, but I grew up hunting and fishing until high school began. But I enjoy my job. Like, I enjoy being around the players. I enjoy being at practice. I enjoy being in the office. I enjoy doing stuff like this with you. So I have this isn't just a job for me. It's a passion. I'm a college baseball fan. And so I'm just very, those two things can take you a long way. And I'm not too, overconfident enough to try and listen and learn along the way. So I feel like, I've evolved over time. So yes, I'm an organized guy. Yes, I believe I'm a big believer in practice, which I don't think many people are today. I think baseball is a game that's actually played at the amateur level. It's played too much and not practiced enough. And Augie used to talk about it all the time, and I always didn't understand. And now I really get it. And if you ask me to talk about myself, I guess it would be some of those things.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. What are the attributes you've seen a lot of good you've worked with both as a coach on a campus, but also in Team USA. You've worked with some really elite coaches and you've seen them. And what are the couple top attributes that you see that are common amongst the great leaders, the great coaches?
I mean, it's the same thing. If you read three different leadership books today and they're on coaching or people running a company or great politicians, I'm a believer that they're all just about the same person. I mean, they may be different personalities, but they have one of my things is, how you do anything is how you do everything. So, they're committed to being the very best they can be in all areas of their life. And they're not perfect, right? There's only ever been one perfect person on this planet, and they nailed him to a cross. Everybody else since has failed. So before and since. They're just committed to doing the right things. And I think most of them they're selfless in terms of they understand what it means to be a servant leader, but they're not soft. And who's in charge, and they're adaptable. They're not afraid to have good constructive conversation about a different way to do things, because that's the only way you get better. And this is probably a negative trait, but I do think it's true for the best. They hate to lose more than they like to win. And, you know, that's a bad thing most of the time. You know, for me, winning never feels as good as losing feels bad. So, you know, I see that in those people. They're organized. Here's one that we're losing in coaching, and which speaks to practice, is if you remember back to my story, the coaches that I grew up under, they were all teachers. So Rick Jones was a middle school baseball coach first out of college. And then he got a high school coaching job, and he thought that was the greatest. And then he got a junior college job at Ferrum College, which is now a four-year school, but it was a junior college. Billy Wagner, if you remember Billy Wagner, the big left-hander reliever for many teams in the big leagues, pitched at Ferrum College. And then he got the job at Elon, which is a great NAIA program. And then he was a Division I assistant, and then he was a great Division I head coach. But my point is, he started out a teacher, like he had to teach classes. And the one common theme that I see among coaches today is they know the skill. They can present it sometimes in a clinic, but they're not good teachers. Or they're having to learn, which they need to learn, how to teach a skill, right? So when I'm taking my education classes, when I'm teaching kindergartners, when I'm teaching in high school, I'm learning how to take a skill, whether it be shoot a free throw, whether it be take a golf swing, whether it be a tennis forehand, and I'm learning how to break that, what the skill looks like, how to break it down in parts to teach the skill. And that's what Jack Leggett did. I mean, Jack Leggett had to teach a lot of class before he was a full-time coach, right? And so did Skip Bertman, and so did, you know, Augie at one point. But they're just great teachers. And, you know, I'm getting way too deep here, but we undervalue teachers in society today. They're teachers, policemen, firemen, they should all be paid way more than a stinking baseball coach. But that's the best coaches are the best teachers. And they understand how to take information that they have and present it to a group effectively so they can learn it.
That's good. I love that. So if you're giving advice to a 23-year-old who just got done playing and he's a volunteer, so he's not in the classroom, he's not kind of, to your point, having that journey, he's a volunteer somewhere or he's at a junior college, how do you encourage that person to do just what you said?
I mean, I think you just... Number one, I would try to get around. I mean, there's no coach I know of that would ever turn away somebody that says, hey, can I come just sit and listen? Can I come sit and watch practice? Not one time has any coach that I know of, and especially our program, ever said to a high school coach, to a junior college coach, to a summer league coach, it doesn't matter. Have we ever said no? It's crazy they don't ask. And I love it when they do it, because I learn. I say, listen, my only requirement when you come here is when you ask a question, I'm going to ask how you do it, because you're going to have something. I come out of every single one of those conversations with something that helps us get better. Yeah. So that would be the first thing. And then the second thing is, I think they should take some continuing education if possible. I think getting your master's degree is valuable. It is very valuable. I don't care really what it's in, but continuing education and learning is great. But I would encourage them to take some teaching courses if they haven't done that. And I'm sure concepts have changed over time, but you just got to want to be a lifelong learner. And I've had some interviews where I brought coaches in to interview, and within the first 15 minutes, I know this is going to be a complete waste of my day, because they want to tell me their hitting system, or they want to tell me how they're the new revamped thing. And, you know, we can eventually get to that, but that's not the most important thing. You know, I want to know, you know, what kind of guy you are and how hard you work and how willing you are to help. And, you know, so that would be my advice, I guess, right off the top of my head.
Yeah, I love that. I interviewed Keegan Cook, who's the head volleyball coach at the University of Washington. And he had talked about, he was at Santa Clara, as a student, and then helped volleyball, and then at night would go coach a club team. And he said he did that for years. And what it did is it gave him reps to coach. He's like, I was always coaching, so I was learning how to do it not under bright lights. I was legitimately in some dark gym with a group of 14-year-old girls teaching them. And he's like, dude, that was so invaluable to me just to get those reps. And I think of young guys getting in the cage and doing lessons, which everyone's probably done. And dude, they can be so painful at times. But when you look back, it's like, man, that actually helped. I got reps in. So
you spurred a thought in me, and that's all the camp I work. See, one of our nowadays recruiting is so intense, and but when I worked all that baseball camp, and then when I got to Tulane, I ran all of our baseball camps I was there 8 years. I think I ran the camps for like the first 4 or 5 years. And I won't name coaches, but I promise you there are coaches in the College World Series today, some of the huge, biggest names in our sport, because I know them well. And I have had guys on my staff and that are out there currently and are out. If I said, hey, you need to go take those 15, 9-year-olds and put together a good base running station. No chance. They would rather, do anything other than try to corral those 15, 9-year-olds, and just whether it be lack of organization, whether it be the inability to project your voice. For instance, I'll watch coaches and they're having a conversation with their team, or say a pitching coach is talking to a group of pitchers and there's pitchers behind them. How in the heck is that a teachable moment when you can't even make eye contact with everybody that you're speaking to? Mm-hmm. Right. So in another example, I don't wear sunglasses on a baseball field. That's not healthy. It's bad. I should do it. But the reason I don't is because I need the player who I'm talking to see my eyes. And a lot of times, if a guy has sunglasses on when I'm talking, would you please take those off? Because I need that interaction. And I learned that there's no way you can teach a kindergarten class and the kid not see your eyes and you can't see theirs. So, those, just what you just said, I learned a lot and failed a lot trying to put all that together.
Yeah, dude, that's so good. It made me think. I was in the off season. I was living in Kansas City, and I was doing some little small camps at a place called Dell's Athletic Club. And I had to give a talk about pitching. And, before I opened my mouth, in my mind, I'm super arrogant. I've got this figured out. I started to talk, Jim, and it was like mumbo jump. I had no idea. But it was that moment of it crystallized like, crap, I don't know this. I thought I did. I thought I was some cool pro ball pitcher. I had zero clue how to teach it. And when you're in front of, it was a small group. But when you're at that point, I'm in front of 8 kids with their parents. I'm like, dude, I was a complete fool, which just basically reiterate to your point, I better figure this. I got to figure out how to communicate this, because I'm not as cool as I think I am.
Yeah. Public speaking class, writing class, just being able to convey information. It doesn't matter what you know if you can't convey it to them, And I just, that's a very common theme among young coaches these days.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned multiple times about just always learning and growing. So I would love to maybe pull up kind of from a 30,000 foot view, and over the course of your 18 years, I think 17 seasons at TCU, how have you changed? What are some key ways where if you look back, you're like, well, yeah, I've changed in these ways?
Yeah, well, the biggest thing, number one, is as an assistant coach, I was the guy that you wanted to hang out with. And I had great relationships with players. If you talk to the kids at Tulane, they would say a lot of great things. And then, I remember Rick Jones saying, all right, popular guy, just remember when those wins and losses go to next to your name, it's going to be different. Mm-hmm. And there's a way different, big difference between making a suggestion and making a decision. And when you jump on the other side of that desk and sit in that chair, things change. And I let them, the changes that happened to me were poor, bad decisions, I was not a fun guy to play for. And I was so and still am, even though I've gotten better. I like to win. How do you spell fun? W-I-N, right? I mean, and so my statement on your question, I've been asked this a lot, is I would personalize the performance of the players. And a lot of this had to do with, you know, I didn't play very long and I wasn't a great player. So, you know, I think there's a lot to the guys who played deep into college, who played professional baseball. And I don't think I had a true appreciation for how hard this game really, really is, and the pressures that go into it. And so I was just so into developing culture, setting rules and standards, having a great practice. And then I felt like if I just did all those things, which you have to do, then we should win the game. Why didn't we win the game? Well, it's because you struck out four times. You know, and I didn't call the kid out, but he could just tell in my body language. Whereas an assistant coach, I would have done a better job of having my arm around him. I was plenty good enough at putting my foot in your butt, but I wasn't sympathetic or empathetic to the players. And so I've really worked on that. I'm still a work in progress on that in terms of just kind of what I. You're practicing, in other words, what I preach, right? So get back to the middle. If you lose and you play, you know, just get back to the middle. I'm plenty good at winning a big game and coming off that and getting back to the middle. But that would be my, you know, my biggest change. You know, we've built our program to the point now where I have, you know, three assistant coaches, but two in particular, Bill Mosiello and Kirk Sarlos, that are super great at what they do. They're very well compensated. And I'm not saying that to brag. I'm saying that because they're not going anywhere. Right. So, I mean, if they leave, it's got to be for a super high end head coaching job, which are hard to get. So what I've been able to do in the last 5 or 6 years is really operate from a 30,000 foot view. And not that I miss being in the bullpen every day and I go down there a lot, but I don't want to step on Kirk's toes. Same thing with the hitters. So I'm certainly heavily involved in every single thing that happens from a baseball standpoint. But at the same time, I really get to study and invest and spend time on individual relationships with players, culture, maintaining that, building that, making it better, you know, that kind of thing. So I guess, you know, it's a long answer, but just enjoying being around the players more. And if I learned anything from COVID up until March 11th of last year, if you'd asked me a question about the games, I would say, I absolutely hate the games. I love the practices. I just want the games to be over with. I want to win them, but I just want them over with. Mm-hmm. And that's self-induced pressure. And once we lost our season last year, I've made a commitment to myself. I've got it written down like on my mirror at home, is I'll never say that again. I'm going to enjoy every day for what it is, enjoy the relationships, enjoy the competition. Believe me, I still, and we will work like crazy to win every ball game. But I really missed it to the point where it was almost someone, you know, hey man, you, we all need a little recorrect. And that's one of the things that I got out of COVID.
Yeah. Dude, thanks for sharing. Yeah, that's really good. I think what you said kind of spurred a question the hating to lose more than you like or love the winning, you know, how would you counsel somebody? And obviously I think probably your counsel would be great, because you're right in the middle of it, struggling with this idea too, to handle the stress, to handle the quote unquote pressure. How would you, if you're giving somebody advice that's kind of walking in your same shoes, which I think most coaches are, it's just the, regardless of where you're at, you want to win so bad, you want players to do well. Yeah. Have you found any things that have really helped you to handle the stress, to be more, as you said, to the middle? Yeah. Give some advice on that.
I don't know if I'm the right guy to give advice on it. You know, I mean, I exercise every day, sometimes twice. I have tried to find an outlet. For example, you know, I'm not a fisherman by any stretch, but when I have had those opportunities, my children are grown, during COVID, I'd have, you know, just some free time. And I have enjoyed just, if it's a 30-minute drive from Fort Worth, to go on some guy's ranch and stand next to a pond and flip a line in the water, even if it, whether it's for an hour or whether it's for 3 hours, that is truly, you know, I wish I would have done more of that. Just even if it's just once a day, once a week, something like that. You know, golf has just never been for me, but I understand why people need, you know, that. It's certainly your family. But here's kind of my theory on that. And this is probably really wrong to say. It's just what I think is that, you know, you hear these coaches at the end of their careers or even towards the end of life, and they'll say, and it doesn't have to be a coach, it's normally, you know, someone that's been super successful, and they say, well, I wish I would have done more of A. I wish I would have enjoyed the journey more. Da, da, da. The only people that ever say that are the ones that won. I've never heard a coach who wasn't any good, or the guy, you know, or didn't win, I've never heard a guy who's, you know, companies went bankrupt three times say that. So I've become, in the last couple months, I've become a big fan of, I've been studying Admiral McRaven. He's a Navy Admiral, I think 4-star, used to be the Chancellor at the University of Texas. He's an awesome speaker. His YouTube thing about if you want to change the world, make your bed every day. If you haven't seen it, it's gone viral. And I really listen and read everything I can find on him. And one of the things he said, the exact same thing in one of his podcasts. And he just said, you know, something has to give, right? There has to be a sacrifice, and that should never be your family, but sometimes it is. And another piece of advice I'd give a coach is, man, you better find the right wife, buddy. And you know, someone that is independent, someone that you can trust, someone that can handle your profession and doesn't mind being alone at times, because it is lonely. And I have no problem admitting, you know, I was married for 23 years and just went through a divorce last February. And that's a failure. That's a failure in my life. It's not 100% on me, but it's certainly, you know, a large percentage. And are there things that did my job and how I approach it cause some of that? There's no question that it did. If I could do it over again, I would do it differently. But I just, if you're going to do this coaching thing in the right way, at least in college athletics, something's got to give. So, you know, I feel great about the father that I was. I could have been a much better husband. But I'm not worried about, I don't feel bad about not being a good golfer, because that would have sacrificed time either A, with my family, or B, with our players. And I just think, you know, it's not the easiest profession. It's very rewarding. But just be prepared to me, the highest success is to be all in. And I think the best ones are.
Yeah, that's good. Jim, thanks. I'm so impressed with your authenticity and humility. Seriously, that's really, for me, it's like a magnet. I'm attracted to people that are like, yeah. Anyways, that's really, I appreciate
you know,
that.
I appreciate you saying that. You know, one of the books, you said you're going to ask me about a book, and which I read and have reread, is it's a book called, oh my goodness, Legacy. Yeah. And it's about, you know, the New Zealand rugby team, the All Blacks, and phenomenal book. And, you know, that one. And then I have a buddy named Ryan Holiday that is just very well written. And his two favorites are Ego is the Enemy and The Obstacle is the Way. And Legacy and Ego, the Enemy, are very similar, because, you know, Legacy talks about humility. And in order to be great, you know, you have to be humble. You have to have some level of humility. I'm sure I can be better, because you have to be self in order. And the best players I've ever been around have been the most self-aware players. The greatest people I've been around have been the most self-aware. So they recognize what they're good at. They recognize what they're bad at. They recognize what they need to get better at. And to do that, you have to have some humility versus the ego is the enemy, you know, side of things. So I guess later in life, I've really tried to dive even in the more to that so I can be better.
That's good. Yeah. Hey, by the way, have you read Stillness is the Key?
I have. Ryan sent me two or three copies of it, and I have like a stack of other things I'm doing. And now I've really dove into podcasts. Yeah. So I love to read, highlight, do all that stuff. I don't like to read online because I like to be able to go back to it. But I haven't. It's literally sitting next to my bed, and I haven't read it yet.
Yeah, gosh, that one. I'd love to follow up with you on just your 5 minute follow up on your take on that, because dude, that talks about just the sitting and being still and letting your mind. I don't know. It was really impactful for me. So I'd be curious how that strikes you.
Yeah, Ryan will be mad that I haven't read it yet. So he lives down in Austin. Had him come talk to our team in 2017. And that was amazing. And so, yeah, I'm on it. Thanks.
Love it. Love it. Okay. Let's dive into your program real quick. Culture. I mean, I think one of the reputations that you have is as you have really built, obviously, TCU program. You've got the reputation as a program builder. And I think one of the keys to building a program is obviously creating culture. And so would love to maybe dive into behind the scenes or maybe a boots on the ground. What does it look like? What are the things you do consistently that drive culture in your program?
Well, the first and most important thing is you have to define your culture. And this is the thing that where most people fail, and it's where I failed. And even when we were in 2009, went to our first Super Regional, 2010, went to the College World Series for the first time, the last one in Rosenblatt Stadium. I know we had a culture, but you couldn't define it. And, you know, if words on a wall don't mean anything, words on a t-shirt don't mean anything, words on a document that you hand out, they don't mean anything. If I can't walk into your company, onto your team and say, what's the culture of this place? Or what does it mean to be an employee at Waste Management in Houston? What does it mean to be a baseball player at TCU? If everybody in the room can't say, well, it means this, it means this, and it means this. If it's not simple and easily stated, then you have a culture. It's just not organized, right? And so that was me until about 2013 or 14 when we work with a sports, you could call him sports psychologist. It's more peak performance coach or sports performance coach by the name of Brian Kane, who began his career in 2006, first with UC Irvine. And then we were the only other group, you know, we were struggling in 2006 and he called us, I needed some help, and we got Brian in to work with us, and he's been working with us ever since. And in 2014, he said, hey, you know, if I went to your players and said, what's it mean to be a baseball player at TCU? What would they say? And I said, well, they better say this and they better say this and they better say that. And he said, all right, let's ask them. So we got in our classroom. It's another piece of advice I would give every coach is to either have a classroom or have access to a classroom. It's life changing, team changing, program changing. Go in our classroom and we ask them that question. They filled out a little survey and we wrote everything up on the wall. It was probably 60 different things, all of them good. All of them, I'm proud of what they wrote, but none of it cleanly stated. And so that's when we came up with our three core values, and not just words on a wall, but we define those. We define what they look like, you know, in examples in the community, on the baseball field, in the weight room, in your faith, if that's part of who you are. And so once we did that, then things became a lot more clear. And you hear that language. I call it the language of your program. What's the language of your company? What are guys saying? What are they believing? And what are they talking about? And how are they holding each other accountable? And so we have our three core values, which is selfless, excellence, and energy. That sounds really coachy, but we define those. We have our mission statement. We define that. They know what it is. And then you can move forward from that. And so a lot of my time and my job is reinforcing that, maintaining that. My passion since COVID has been to try and even bring that more succinct. I've been listening to a Urban Meyer podcast over and over. It's about 10 episodes long with Tim Kite, who wrote his book Above the Line. And he's so good at just plainly stating, you know, what a leadership should look like, what your culture should look like. He talks about, you know, your culture is basically what you practice, what you promote, and what you permit, right? And the old coaching saying is, you know, what you permit, you promote. So, you know, if not standing on the line is okay, then you're promoting lack of attention to detail, you know, or showing up late or whatever. And so I'm trying to even do a better job. I have all these, you know, cool sayings from all these books I've read and all these things, and they constantly get thrown out. But if I can't go to, if you can, as an outsider, Travis, go to one of my players and say, hey, I see that thing on the wall over there where it says, you know, champions behave like champions before they're champions. You know, there's a winning standard of performance before you get to the finish line. That's a Bill Walsh quote. What does that mean? If he can't explain that to you, then it's totally useless. So it just makes me feel better. It looks cool when someone walks through the room. So that's my passion, has been to, you know, pare that down. And yes, we have our rules. Yes, we have our standards. But the players will tell you that I don't believe in goals in my profession. I think goals, and this is, I think this was John Gordon that wrote this. I'm not sure, but I claim it. Goals are performance based, standards are behavior based. And so what I've learned the most in my career, in my profession, and this speaks to our mission statement at TCU, our mission statement in our baseball program is to help the mission of the program is to help each and every person within the program, not just players, but everybody, to become the very best selfless version of themselves. And so if you think about it, if I can get every kid on the team, coach, myself, equipment manager, if I can get them to be the very best version of themselves, self and selfless, like committed to the team concept and the best in all areas of their life, the baseball stuff's going to take care of itself, right? So I'm spinning here talking, so because I do get passionate about this, but that's, you know, that's been my challenge is to try and find ways, give our players and staff every single resource they need to help them do your job. You know, if they can't define, if they can't speak that language to you and explain it, then I've failed. And so I'm constantly working on that.
That's so good. Okay, so I was going to end on that, but you said something that I got to dive into a little bit. You mentioned the classroom. How big a change it was, or, you know, the impact it's had with you. Give us flesh that out a little bit. Explain that.
Okay. So, all right. So here, I always couldn't stand this. So I think players need, in the sport of baseball and probably in all sports, and you could probably transfer this over to business. So I think players need three spaces. They need a place to get dressed and undressed. They need a place to hang out, and they need a place to learn. Well, the place to get dressed and undressed is called a locker room, right? A place to hang out, especially baseball is a hangout sport, right? We show up three and a half hours before a game to play another three and a half hours, right? We have to take batting practice, then we have to go sit around for a little bit while they're taking batting practice, and, you know, so forth. Anyway, that's called a lounge. And then they need a place to learn. Well, what's that called? It's a classroom, right? Well, 90% of the places in the country, including TCU until 2016, that all happened in the same space, a locker room. So you walk into a locker room, you have the lockers where they get dressed and undressed. There's some couches. There's maybe a ping pong table. There's maybe a computer. There's a couple TVs, whatever. There's your lounge, right? And then when I want to go in and talk about bunt defense, or if I want to have Brian Kane come in, or if I want to have Ryan Holiday come in, or if I want our FCA guy to come in and run a baseball chapel, where does it all happen? It happens in the same place. Yeah. And so to walk in that place and try to get 35, 18 to 22 year olds, you know, number one, dressed, you know, number two, pay attention and forget about, you know, whatever you were just talking about and pay attention on the subject we're about to discuss, that's a nightmare and it's not fair. And so now I really encourage coaches, even if you're at a high school, you have access to classrooms. It doesn't have to be at the field. There's a classroom somewhere, right? Or even if you created one, not a true classroom, but just did something off-site in a tent, I don't care, something that's separate to where now, if I had you come to our classroom today and I said, all right, we're going to meet with the guys, you would hear them coming down the hall and they would be, you know, jacking around, doing things that college boys do. But as soon as that door opens, the entire atmosphere changes. Mm-hmm. They know now we're here to learn something. We're here to have, it may be the scouting report video for the game tonight. It may be Coach Mo going over first to thirds or showing video on a cut and relay. But and I go back to, I'm a teacher at heart, and that's, teaching doesn't happen in a locker room, right? It should happen in a classroom. And we know the field is that too, but that's really just been a game changer for us in every sense of the word, even with baseball instruction. So yeah. I'm super passionate about, I'm hoping that they'll let me coach at TCU for another 10 or 15, 20 years. But if for some reason I'm somewhere else, I'll never coach anywhere without it.
Love that. That's good. Thanks for fleshing that out. Okay, I end with three questions. The first one, you've kind of already alluded to it, so I'm going to tweak this question a little bit. It's the, what are you reading? What has been the book over the last, I don't know, couple years that has had the biggest impact on you?
Well, the book that's other than the Bible that's had the biggest impact on me is The Compound Effect by Darren Hardy. It's a book that we have the players read every year. Now, there's an app out there called Optimize. I don't know if you use it. Our team uses it, but it basically gives you the cliff notes of all these great leadership motivational books. But The Compound Effect is just something that's a huge part of the language of our program. And it's basically built on the premise, would you rather have $3 million today in a check here or cash, here you go, or would you rather have a one penny compounded, meaning it doubles in value every day for 31 days, right? And so obviously it's a trick question, but if people don't know the answer, they normally say, well, give me the 3 million. But what you don't understand is eventually the penny compounded for 31 days ends up being over $10 million. But you don't have more than 3 million even until on the 29th day, you have less money than the $3 million guy. But on the 31st day, you have three times as much money as him, right? So it just speaks to good, daily, consistent, positive choices, which create positive routines, which create positive habits, you know, and your life is just a sum of, you know, the biggest quote in our stadium is, excellence is not an event, it's a habit. You are what you repeatedly do. Aristotle said that. So that's our program is really built on that, trying to get kids to make good, positive daily choices. And so this book, The Compound Effect, it's real, it's super easy read. You can do it in one sitting, but it sits right by my desk. It's highlighted, it's dog-eared, it's everything.
Yeah, I love it. Okay, second question I asked, what advice would you give? You've already talked about loyalty, work ethic, and knowledge that was given to you. Anything else, any other advice you'd give a young person just getting into the coaching profession?
It's a lifestyle. It's not a profession. If you are getting in this job to make money, get out. And I say that, and, you know, My current job at TCU pays a lot of money, but I tell people that the most money I ever had was when I didn't have any, because you had no bills, right? So when I'm at Clemson and I had saved $5,000 and me and Maisie are living on an orange shag apartment that was $180 a month, I was like, I got $5,000. Like, this is, what else do I need? You know? And I just believe the longer that you can make career decisions based on money, the more money you're going to make. Yeah. And everybody has to feed their family. Everybody has that, you know, that's, and our profession, one thing that's awful about college baseball is we have, our, our entry level jobs are so bad because this volunteer coach thing is such a joke. But it is what it is. And so, in other words, I tell young, attach yourself to a winner. So, for example, when I was at Clemson, I was only there in the fall. I was there for the first fall of 1992, and 22 years old. And Vanderbilt at the time, which certainly wasn't Vanderbilt that Coach Corbin has built, but Vanderbilt was an SEC school, and they were looking for a restricted earnings coach, which was a new position, to help coach the pitchers. And the coach there, Roy Mewburn at the time, who Coach Corbin replaced, called Coach Wilhelm, and Coach Wilhelm gave him my name. And Coach Wilhelm asked me if I wanted to go take the job. And I'm like, at Vanderbilt, you know, which even speaks greater to what Coach Corbin's built. They had no commitment to the sport, and they weren't very good in the SEC. And I'm at Clemson, man, like, just got back from Omaha and got this great team and these great coaches. And I'm like, no chance. I don't, you couldn't pay me $40,000 to go, you know, do that. I want to be here. I want to learn from Jack Leggett. I want to learn from Randy Mazey. I want to learn from Bill Wilhelm. And I've continued to do that throughout my career, even with head coaching decisions. And I'm a huge believer in that. And if I'm interviewing somebody, in the first couple minutes or on the phone, they say, well, what's the position pay? I'm out. You know, that's not how this thing works, I think, in this profession.
Yeah. Love it. Good stuff. And I end with this. Who would you love to hear on this podcast talk about their, you know, hear their journey, hear how they articulate leadership and their strengths and attributes? Yeah.
Well, I think people would really enjoy. I talked about Mike Bianco earlier. He's one of my dearest friends, and he's had a phenomenal journey, and just what he's done to build that program under the bright lights of the SEC has just been absolutely amazing. And so he's a guy that, I mean, I know his story, but I think people would really benefit from his story as well.
Love it. Love it. Jim, dude, thanks. Appreciate it. I know you're with family there in Maryland, so I appreciate you taking time for me.
You got it, man. I've enjoyed it.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm assuming if you made it this far that you enjoyed the conversation. Would you please leave a review and pass this podcast along to anyone else that you think might enjoy it? If you have any suggestions for the show, I'm always looking to grow and to improve the show, email me at travis@kingdomcoachingtw.com. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, have a good one.